Well, Russia and its leader Vladimir Putin are never long out of the headlines of late. And this week, it's the US Senate Intelligence Committee's finding that Russia mounted a campaign of propaganda on steroids, was their quote, seeking to influence the 2016 US presidential election that we were just talking about there with Tom Clark. We've also witnessed via our television screens the intriguing visit late last month of Marine Le Pen to visit Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin, the far right of France meeting, in theory anyway, the far left, in terms of Putin being a product of a communist regime and set of theories about the world. Then we learned the Russian president has backed Le Pen financially. So perhaps the visit wasn't all that surprising. What is the organising logic behind this backing, you might well ask? Is it any more than mischievous meddling? Well, Luke Harding, who's joining us now, thinks the answer is a definite yes. He was The Guardian's former Moscow bureau chief till 2011 when he was deported by the Kremlin for his investigative work on the awful murder by poison in London of the Russian envoy Alexander Litvinenko. He sees some repeated patterns behind the Russian strategy, which he thinks ought to be articulated more clearly, so that all of us are alert and alarmed, governments and public alike. These tactics also play directly into the role of modern cyber warfare, highlighted by the still unclear scale of Russian penetration elsewhere, made even more pressing by the vital German, let alone the French elections, fairly close now. So, Luke Harding, I'm looking forward to hearing your analysis. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Great to be with you.
And you suggest this is a strategy that is deeply cynical, bordering on nihilistic. Maybe you could explain further, please.
Well, actually, what the Kremlin's been doing under Vladimir Putin is not new. It dates back to the Soviet Union, to communism, and to something that the Politburo used to call active measures, which was essentially trying to kind of destabilize Western countries, to use disinformation, to create fake news, if you like. We're not talking about now, we're talking about in the sort of 60s and 70s and 80s. And what you have to remember, of course, is that Putin is himself a former KGB spy who spent much of his career in the 1980s in communist East Germany and Dresden. And essentially, this is the old KGB playbook, if you like, updated for the modern cyber age. So we see influence operations going on, we see trolls, we see financing of the far right, as you said in your introduction, and indeed the far left.
Well, that's right, both sides.
And we've seen an attempt to undermine, if you like, kind of European and Western solidarity and transatlantic alliances.
But you put in your article that it was to persuade citizens of the West that all rulers everywhere are sort of equally decrepit and corrupt. That's a pretty devastating and diabolical strategy.
Well, I mean, essentially, I think Putin thinks that we, by which I mean the Western world sort of generally, we're all suckers, actually. And there is no such thing as kind of human rights or kind of free, influence-free elections or kind of real democracy. That essentially, I think the word is nihilistic, that it's a kind of jungle in which big states act in the way that big states always have done through history, which is to steamroll the small states and to kind of push through their sort of political and their kind of national objectives. Now, I think what's happening at the moment, I think we're in a kind of really precarious position historically, is a kind of affront, almost a kind of arrogant affront towards the whole kind of Western liberal international order, the sort of the law-based world that we've known pretty much since the Second World War for about sort of 70 years. And what Putin is trying to do is turn the clock back to, you might say, the 1890s or the kind of late imperial age, where it's all about deal making, it's all about grand bargains, it's all about stitching up parts of the world into spheres of influence. It's his plan, and he thinks that anyone who opposes him is naive because he understands how the world is, and we're just fools for thinking it's any different.
But is it to sort of augment Russian power to get them back on the stage, or to somehow just create a lot of trouble or a lot of diversion?
Well, it's both. I mean, if you look at the information tactics, there's a strategy that the hacking of the US election, the role of Russia Today, RT, the Kremlin's English language propaganda service, the idea isn't really to kind of persuade people that Russia is a great, shiny, country free of corruption. It's to say, you guys, your politicians are no better. They're as grasping, as venal, as corruptible, as failed as our politicians. And actually, there's no real truth out there at all. There's merely narrative. There's merely kind of different states sort of shouting. And so
that's what he wants the West to believe.
So they spin off conspiracy theories. They say MH17, for example, the Malaysian Airlines plane shot down in 2014 over eastern Ukraine by, we think, a kind of Russian rocket system, that they say that it was full of dead bodies, that the Ukrainians did it, that the CIA did it. And even though this may not sort of persuade everybody, it means that the kind of true version, that these were Russian-backed separatists who actually murdered almost 300 people, escapes. And that's the point. The point is that you
muddy the waters.
Assaulting truth itself, and by muddying the waters, it means that your sovereign goals, your political objectives, you can get away with it.
Well, you also suggest he does not favour, in general, multilateral organisations or plans or treaties, that he likes to deal one-on-one or country-to-country bilateral dealings. Why would this suit him?
Well, because it's much easier to corrupt or to influence a political leader, a single political leader, than to kind of flip a multilateral bloc like, say, the European Union, which is a kind of institutionally strong. I mean, despite its failings and problems and so on, it's still a institutionally strong and kind of robust bloc led by Europe's most powerful politician, that's Angela Merkel. What Putin prefers to do is to find flawed, businessmen who've gone into politics, populists, with whom he can do kind of crony deals. And previously, that was kind of Gerhard Schröder in Germany, who's got a job with basically Gazprom, with the Russian sort of state on a new pipeline, and Silvia Berlusconi, and you can see why that might work. And of course, the new man in the White House, Donald Trump, who's a classic example of this. Trump prides himself as a deal maker. He's not really much of an analyst. We don't quite know what his sort of foreign policy is, and he is the perfect partner for Putin and for Russia.
So where do you rate the Marine Le Pen visit in this analysis then?
Well, I mean, again, if you go back in communist times, you had kind of Moscow supporting primarily the left, sort of communist parties in Europe and elsewhere, and various kind of front organizations. And now what you see is actually the Kremlin covertly, and sometimes not so covertly, like with Marine Le Pen, backing the far right and backing the far left as well. There's a kind of what you might call a sort of red-brown convergence, because the far left, Jeremy Corbyn, people around him in my country, in the UK, they think that all evil in the world flows from American imperialism, and that Russia opposes American hegemony, and that therefore in some way should be admired and respected. And on the far right, you have people like Nigel Farage, the kind of UKIP populist, the guy who gave us Brexit, who think that all evil flows from the European Union and see Russia.
And we have in Australia Pauline Hanson, who thinks that Putin represents the fundamental business of a strong leader and that we need one.
Well, right. So there are people on the far right who love autocrats and who like the sort of Christian-inflected, almost sort of white nationalist message, the sort of Steve Bannon-y message. And so Putin is playing both ends. And what I find kind of very depressing as someone I'm a kind of liberal. I'm a sort of almost like a kind of panda. I'm practically an endangered species in 2017. But what I find so depressing is you can see why people on the far right like this kind of strongman sort of stuff. But it's people who are progressive who also think there's something forward-looking about contemporary Russia. I mean, Russia is basically an ultra-nationalist kleptocracy presided over by someone who we now know, thanks to a public inquiry into the murder of Alexander Litvinenko in 2006, someone who kind of murders his enemies. I mean, there's nothing really notable about current Russia at all. There's nothing about brotherhood or socialism. This is a hyper-capitalist state run by a very, very corrupt feudal or neo-feudal elite.
You also make the point, and others have too, that this is a classic it was almost a perfect storm. The internet makes cyber warfare or cyber interference much easier. It's much cheaper than invading armies. And all sorts of nations are massively upgrading, particularly the Germans. They've looked on and seen what's happening, and they've got their big election coming up, and they're massively upgrading their cyber counterterrorism capabilities. So what sort of a role do you think Russian mastery or expertise in cyberspace is contributing to this thesis you're describing, or these tactics you're describing?
Well, I mean, I think in some ways the way you sort of talk about it there, it makes it sound grander than it is. I mean, you have to realize that this is relatively low key. It's kind of cheap. It's sort of budget, and it's opportunistic in character. In other words, you get a few criminal hackers, you kind of recruit or co-opt them, and then you get them to hack things, or you get a warehouse of sort of amoral students in St. Petersburg. You pay them $15,000 a year, and you get them to write 200, 300 blog posts every day on Australian, you know, British, American websites praising Putin and decrying people who have the kind of temerity to criticize the Russian government. So it's a sort of shoestring operation, but it's sort of devastating in its effectiveness, because a lot of people don't realize, they can't spot it, they can't decode it. And what's interesting is that countries like the Baltics, Finland, those that neighbor Russia and remember the Cold War, they understand this sort of propaganda a bit better. But people in the US will click on something that comes up from Facebook and they'll think it's real. Then they won't know that it's a bot, or it's a sort of Macedonian fake news factory, or it's someone sitting in St. Petersburg who calls themselves John but is actually called Sergey.
Well, I noticed that
the
Czech government is setting up a specialist anti-fake news unit because it believes the Kremlin's behind around 40 Czech language websites spreading radical views and inaccurate stories, with the eventual goal to flip the Czech Republic from west to east aligned.
Well, that's right. And what you have to kind of almost admire about the current Russian government is it has a sort of criminal energy to it. It's ambitious and it's ruthless and it's quick. I mean, you can see Europe trying to do something about all this stuff, but we're kind of behind the curve. I mean, Russia today is the Kremlin's propaganda sort of channel. Russia today is very well entrenched. It's in my gym. That they pay Western hotels to screen it in the lobby. That they,
this is RT.
I mean, Putin is very, very good at propaganda. I mean, they can't win medals cleanly in the Olympics and in sporting competitions. There's no road between Moscow and St. Petersburg. The Russian economy is in serious trouble, especially since 2014 and the collapse of the ruble. But when it comes to propaganda, these guys are world masters. They're the best.
Well, you do make the point that, of course, they're not the only ones trying to interfere in other countries' affairs. But I noticed Dr. Lucas Kellow, who's from the director of the Cyber Studies Program at Oxford University, writing in the New Statesman, had something very interesting. He points out that international law does not prohibit interstate espionage. Domestic penal codes criminalise the sort of unauthorised access to computer systems, but no international treaty forbids this activity. This is new territory for diplomacy.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating point. I mean, I think the best analogy for where we are at the moment with cyberspace is it's like the high seas of the 18th century, where you have privateers, you have vessels full of kind of people who are kind of armed, sometimes acting on behalf of the state, sometimes acting for themselves. And that's what we have here now. I mean, we see basically criminal hackers who have tried to steal money from Russian banks, who are then tapped on the shoulder by the FSB, the Russian spy agency, and said, and told basically, you know, cooperate with us or go to jail or worse. And there are no rules. There are no rules. But I mean, I think what's happened in the US is clearly pretty troubling, because if you believe the dossier by Christopher Steele, the former British intelligence officer, even if you only believe some of it, there seems to have been collusion or cooperation, or however you want to call it, between Team Trump and Russian intelligence officers to hack Democratic Party emails and to damage and destroy Hillary Clinton in the run-up to last year's US election. So this is very, very serious.
So Luke, before we have everyone slitting their throats, what do we do about all of this? Are we being played by Putin? Are we giving him more power or influence than we ought to?
Well, you know, Putin is not some kind of uber gremlin who's got a million minions that he commands by pressing a button. It's not like that. There are kind of feuds inside the Russian bureaucracy. There are rivalries within the elites. There's an awful lot of money at stake. And so it's more chaotic than it seems. I mean, that's one point. The other point I would just make is, for your esteemed listeners, is pay for real news. I mean, pay for The Guardian. If
you don't like
The Guardian, if you don't like The Guardian, buy another newspaper. But I think it's more important than ever that actually people support genuine journalism. They support investigative work, the kind of stuff that I do and my colleagues do and other media institutions do, that you kind of help us with method. I mean, I think more than ever, what we need is sort of cool, dispassionate, empirical investigations that lead to kind of properly sourced and researched stories. And I think if people don't help journalism in this kind of parlous moment, then I think democracy is in trouble in Australia, in Europe, in the US, everywhere.
Contribute to a business model that works. Okay, I like hearing that. Luke Harding, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And Luke is the former Moscow bureau chief of The Guardian. His latest book is A Very Expensive Poison. And this, of course, is in relation to the Litvinenko murder. It's published by Vintage.